Lonick, you're our legal counsel here. These will not have to be closed because we're not giving away any trade secrets, right?
Yeah, we were assuming that nothing would be closed.
But are we, do we need to broadcast or not?
Well, there, it's a docketed case.
So broadcast, okay.
All I was planning on doing today was just status.
Yep.
Okay, so I'll stop coming, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, I'll just set it up. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kulk. It's January 31st, 2013. We're meeting the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It's a little bit after 2 o'clock, and we're meeting for basically an update on several grain insolvencies. And I'll give you a variety of case numbers, GE 11-51, GE-12-78, and GE-12-769. I'm joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Crispin and Commissioner Fedorchuk. Alana Jeff-Zacko is with us, General Counsel, and Sue Richter will be in here shortly as the director for that. Basically, before I turn over to my colleagues in the comments, I think the goal that we wanted for this work session is just a status update in a variety of these cases. And so the General Counsel will go through any of the updates, and we'll just answer any questions we might have. We don't have anything particularly... I shouldn't say anything of particular interest, one or two items. I think the course has pretty much been laid on what we're going to do. And then there's no need to close this work session because everything we're doing now is there's not any strategy session that we're talking about here. So if there was a, and this, Lana, please correct me here, if there was something that one of the commissioners functionally wanted to double check and change in the strategy, we might convene a separate work session for that.
Correct.
So, with that, I would turn it over to Commissioner Crispin. If you've got any comments, it's your portfolio.
The only comment that I have is a point of perspective. It's hard to believe on a day when it's not even going to get up to zero. But unless it's an extraordinary winter, within 60 days, some of the farmers that we want to protect here are going to be in the field already.
It is hard to believe, isn't it?
60 days.
Thank you, Randy.
I have no comments.
All right. I know Sue is going to join us, but Alana, if you just wanted to start, I'm sure we can forge forward.
Okay. I don't have my numbers memorized, so which one do you want to start with by name?
You pick.
I mean, I don't know what 1151 is.
You pick, Alana, and we'll figure it out.
1151, Mitchell. What is that? That's Mitchell. Oh, the oldest one. I should figure that out. Yeah, okay. Mitchell is a roving grain buyer insolvency, and Mitchell is a situation that he was doing business as a roving buyer for some time before he ever became licensed. And so you do have two categories of potential claimants in Mitchell, those from before he was licensed and those from after he was licensed, okay? You have a large, I don't want to go into specific numbers, but if Sue is here, she might have them in her head. But a large number of claims and a large dollar value to the claims and a small bond of $70,000. Mitchell does have some interesting complications, for lack or side facts. A group of farmers who are some of the claimants in the insolvency did sue in Minnesota because Mitchell had seed in Minnesota in a warehouse, in an unlicensed warehouse in Minnesota. And they sued in Minnesota on replevin, which is sort of to get return the seed back. And the reason that they sued for that is because there was also a lien. Mitchell had given a bank a lien, and the bank thought the seed was its collateral. And the bank won that case in Minnesota. So there is a judgment in Minnesota that the bank has the prior top lien on any seed that was in this unlicensed warehouse in Minnesota. And that the farmers appealed that but dropped their appeal fairly soon after they first appealed it. And after the Minnesota proceeding, but before they dropped their appeal, the farmers brought a declaratory judgment request, a motion for declaratory judgment in our insolvency proceeding. And that played itself out. Now, a motion for declaratory judgment is a procedural thing where you ask the court to rule on a point of law so that you have the answer to that point of law when you go and do everything else you have to do in this case. There are parameters on it. There are constraints on it because courts aren't supposed to give, quote, unquote, advisory opinions. They're not advising you like your lawyer's supposed to advise you. And so you only give – you are entitled to a declaratory judgment in very narrow situation, okay? The farmers thought that they had met the standards for getting a declaratory judgment on the question of whether those seeds should be part of the trust. And we filed a brief supporting them. And the bank, of course, filed a brief opposing them and raising a lot of things, including the fact that this question was res judicata in the Minnesota case.
Having been tried before.
Right. You don't get two chances at the same legal argument. And there's certain legal things that have to be met for res judicata to apply. There's certain legal things for collateral estoppel to apply. The court in the case, in this argument over the declaratory judgment, determined that the farmer's request for declaratory judgment should be dismissed because the issue of whether the seeds are part of the trust or not was between the trustee, the commission, and the bank. Okay, and that was about, this is the same judge, by the way, as in Smith Contracting's summary judgment decision. There wasn't a lot of additional rulings or anything by the judge on any of the merits that went into this argument for why they deserved a declaratory judgment on the seeds or not. So no one appealed that, which is, you know, so where it stands now. At that time when that was issued, the appeal was still pending in the Minnesota case, but it's since been withdrawn or dropped. So what we have today as far as status is we have an open insolvency with a lot of information filed on claims, but not necessarily enough information, depending on which legal track we decided to go down from here. We may need a lot more information on the claims, a lot more discovery on the claims. But we're in that claims analysis status before we write what the recommendation of trustee or the report and recommendation of trustee. When staff puts that together and the commission votes on it, that's where the commission is saying, here's what we think the assets are, here's what we think the claims are, here's who we think should be paid and why and shouldn't be paid and why, da-da-da-da-da-da, bottom dollar figure, X amount. And then staff brings that to the commission. Commission decides, yes, file that, or no, go change it or go do something.
So where are we at
more
in that time frame?
So the that case has been sitting for a little while because we were going to have an executive session, if you recall, before the end of the year.
Absolutely.
When Bonnie was still on the commission. In order to discuss the potential next steps for staff. Okay.
And we opted at that point to say, time out, let's get the new commissioners on board.
It was kind of rushing along then anyway because it was the end of the year. You know, Commissioner Kramer wouldn't be there. Commissioner Fetch wouldn't be there. So do we get it done or do we not get it done? So there's a little bit of staff homework to do, but probably the next step for that is to come into executive session and discuss the options.
So are you currently analyzing the claims? That's already done?
Yeah, they have been reviewed.
Right. And we could produce a report of, and you probably have those numbers in your head. We had them ready for that meeting, the total claims, the total dollar figures and the total before licensing and after licensing. Because there are, in addition to the little bit of legal, discussion that will go on in the executive session about which way to go and how to go about it, there are policy issues that the commission will have to ask itself about. One is the most important one, I guess, being whether people before the licensing period should share in the bond or not. I mean, that's, and we have some precedent, and we can go over it if you want to get your mic. So the couple other times the commission's addressed that issue, a little bit different factual situation. That's a really big one, though, that the commission will need to think through, because you will want to be following what you do in the next one, in the next one. And it really is policy. But if you want to go over what we've done before, the two cases, Goose River and whoever it is.
The first one was a company called Sterco, and they were operating an elevator down in Sturum, North Dakota. And there were farmers that delivered grain before the license and bond was in place. And they operated just a few months and ended up going through a failure. And so when the commission evaluated the claims and made a recommendation to court, our recommendation was that only the claims that were filed for grain delivered while the license was in place would be considered a valid claim. And one of the claimants showed up at court. He objected, saying that he assumed that they were licensed and bonded, and there actually was enough bond proceeds, and so the judge allowed his claim, determined it to be valid, and he did receive payment.
Do you think that was based on the fact that there was money, or the fact that that's what he thought the law should be?
Possibly
I think it's
money.
Both. Well, it's both, though, because we have another decision. We have a recent decision in Grabansky that says the bond is there to protect the wrongdoing, the default, and that happened during the bonding period, okay? That didn't happen when you delivered the grain, but this is a facility. Because you delivered it, but the wrongdoing happened later when you couldn't pay or get it back in the bond period. And so there's some law, and there's some, yes, there was enough bond money to go around going on there. So one of the things that I was going back and doing and not completely finished with in Mitchell was to identify exactly when each load of grain was sold to Mitchell, and I don't mean to use sold in the magic legal term because that's another issue. Was it sold or wasn't it sold? But delivery, for lack of a better term, you don't deliver to roving buyers, but what was the date of each one of those? What was the payment term supposed to be? 10 days? So when was, if I'm going to get into this, I have to be able to argue it was the default was or wasn't within the bond period, okay, and then bring that to the commission with my ducks in a row, and that's not, that bit of homework is not finished. But in theory, you could have a farmer who made the deal, or he picked up the grain, but the payment wasn't due, and in between was the license, okay? Then we have a slight variation, because doesn't the bond have a couple extra days on it or something in this? There's something, the license period and the bonding period are slightly off, I think.
Oh, it's just because you get a bond is filed, and the date that the liability commences on the bond is generally when the bonding company executes the bond, which we're always going to get it at a later date than that.
Yeah.
So you have liability commencing before it even gets filed here and before the commission can even approve issuing the license.
In this case, we need to know what all those dates are. So that's one of the issues. And then the other precedent.
Before we leave that precedent, did you say that the judge ruled that the bond was to protect the wrongdoing, and it didn't necessarily did that occur at the wrongdoing for the guy that got the money?
Yes,
occurred after the bond.
Yes, the day of default. Yes,
was after
the thing
the bond.
You're paying a bonding company to protect you against.
So if it had, if the day of default had been
prior,
he might not have done the same thing. We had the same issue in Grabansky because there was enough bond to go around there too, but the bonding company was trying to argue that it shouldn't be liable for those deliveries before. It was a different bonding company earlier, so you had bonding company 1 and 2, and number 2 was saying, well, those couple should be under bonding company 1. But we argued no. We argued consistent with what we were told in the Sterco, and the judge found for us in Grabansky. So now we have 2 rulings saying that.
How much does it matter what jurisdiction these are heard in for the precedents? Is it?
You mean what district?
Yeah.
It doesn't. District court precedent really isn't much of anything. I mean, we have to follow it. They're telling us what to do, but it's always an open question until the Supreme Court decides it.
Okay.
There are plenty of Supreme Court cases here and elsewhere saying bonds protect against the default, that's what they're for. So that's very consistent with state law, state court precedent.
And Sue, in your expertise and Alana's, do we have a problem in the state with people not operating without bonds?
Well, it's illegal for them to buy grain without.
Absolutely, but is this the case where you think these were isolated incidents, or we've got a big concern in the state where people are running around buying without bonds?
Well, I'm sure that there are probably always unlicensed grain buyers operating without a bond. It's hard for us to find them. It's easy to find a grain warehouse because you have a building sitting out someplace, and,
right.
You know, those are easy to find. It's hard to find the ones that don't operate facilities. And we go through, and we've gone through, and we've had education seminars or programs, whatever, that we've put together to try and remind people, you know, sell to licensed grain buyers only. We have all of the names of our licensees posted on the commission's website. That's updated on a daily basis. We ask people to, you know, give us a call. We ask our industry to help police it for us.
And that's what I wanted to bring out. Is
it?
I was hoping you'd say that because we've had that discussion before, but it's one of those constant awareness things. Like we were just over at the Grainman's Convention that don't, because when they go buy stuff, they don't show them their badge before they do it.
Right. And we always say, you know, even if they give you a license in North Dakota is going to be 4 digits, it's going to begin with a 1, a 2, a 3. And if it's not 4 digits and doesn't begin with one of those numbers, then you were looking at a license in another state, and please call us before you do anything. Sure. And the other thing is if you contact a grain buyer in another state, also be careful, because if you contact them and you move your grain, then you are subject to the laws of the state where you took your grain out of North Dakota and sold it to. And that's another one that's really scary.
So when should we schedule this next executive session? Do we need to do it before the next commission meeting to schedule it then? Or that's where
I wouldn't be ready. There is also some related legal work that needs to be done. There's a case I've been meaning to read that I haven't on the validity of
extraterritorial. Well, let's schedule the executive session next commission meeting.
You could schedule it then.
If that's okay. And then whatever recommendation you two come back with the dates, just so I know that, Randy and Julie and I it's getting pretty full out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, if it's June, if it's May, whatever, but let's just get it in the calendar and we can work with it.
Okay, that's good.
I have a question on Mitchell specifically. So what assets are in the trust fund?
Nothing.
A bond, $70,000 bond.
And is it here now? Did we get it paid over?
So all the seed was in that deal in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
That's all done. We have no hope of getting any of that.
We're going to talk about.
In executive
That's what we're going to talk about.
Good question.
But there's no grain that we have on hand.
Maybe we should hold that discussion.
Yeah.
For the executive.
By definition, a roving grain buyer doesn't have grain, but they're a broker.
Yeah, they usually
there's a lot of possible arguments. There's a lot of possible arguments pro and con on that one.
But I think any time that we'd want to sit down with Sue, she could walk you through all the questions that you have, and that'd be perfect to have before the executive session.
Yes, we would be willing to do that with anybody. It's a good idea.
And then the other case that we didn't get to would be one called Goose River that never was licensed but was operating without a license. And the commission actually asked to be appointed trustee in an insolvency proceeding, and we were granted that, and we were able to liquidate the proceeds that
were. What year is that one?
In that elevator.
Is that before my time?
Oh, yes. Goose River's been a long time ago.
I can't remember.
That's been quite some time ago.
Okay, so what was the next? Is there any more on Mitchell till we move on?
There really is no more on Mitchell. That's the status, and you have some good idea now, I think, of the issues.
The executive session.
And perfect. Yeah.
All right, what was the next one we wanted to go through?
So the next one, 1278.
Okay.
And which case is that?
Anderson Seed.
That's Anderson. Okay. Well, Anderson Seed has Anderson, I don't know how much you know of background, basically sold its facility and assets and not its liabilities to Legamex. Yeah. Anderson is a big insolvency, a lot of claims for a lot of different things, including grain, in three states, three lawsuits going on, creditors suing them, and a lot of things happening, and everybody's after some of the assets to help pay. For our purposes, we have received some of the information that we have been asking for in order to review claims, but not all of it. We have an outside attorney on this one. Because of the complexity, John Jensen from Grand Forks. And we chose John after talking to probably six or eight different possible attorneys, and either they had conflicts or...
Are you doing Mitchell Seeds yourself?
Yes, I'm doing Mitchell Seeds with help from Doug Anderson downstairs in the AG's office when he has time. And
on a sidebar, there's cost ticking up and all these things that goes back to some of our budget requests, too.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so John, all right.
So we have John, and, you know, he was recommended, and he was recommended by Mitch, which I think says something. But he's also in Grand Forks, and he could deal in Fargo. The case is in Cass County, a little bit easier, and save a little travel money and that sort of thing. Basically, we are appointed trustee. We've had a scheduling conference. We've been very open about the issues. There is a vast amount of seed that was moved, that was purchased by Legamex. We knew this way in the beginning before they even went, you know, we even opened the insolvency. Purchased by Legamex and moved to Minnesota for processing by Legamex, which we are questioning whether Legamex purchased it as a buyer in the ordinary course of business. If they did, they take it free of the farmer's lien, and if they didn't, they take it subject to the farmer's lien, which means it would be trust fund money, trust fund seed. And we...
Is that a complicated thing to determine?
Yes. It's fact dependent. It depends on all of the circumstances surrounding this liquidation, basically. Well, surrounding the purchase.
Whether they bought it free of...
Well, it's whether they bought it in the magic words called buyer in the ordinary course of business. Oh. Okay. And then they take free of the lien even if they know about the lien. Okay. So...
I was going to say one way to look at it is as a buyer in the ordinary course is if you had 1,000,000 hundredweight of sunflower seeds, you might sell it to three different buyers versus selling it all to one
Well,
buyer.
She's getting into possible facts, but not necessarily. I don't think we should go into them at this point, but okay. It's fact specific. There's going to be a lot of discovery that needs to be done in a proceeding over that. And we did have a commission meeting some time ago talking with the lawyer, and I believe that was not a closed meeting. I think that was an open meeting.
Was executive session, wasn't it?
I didn't think so, because I remember them listening, but whatever. Anyway, giving some, yeah. So anyway, that's to proceed on that issue. And we basically think that the proceeding needs to, and the parties know about this because they've been informed about this by our attorney, to proceed on that issue, and the attorney, our attorney and the others think that it needs to be in a separate proceeding. So right now we're in the process of figuring that out with him. By a separate proceeding, I mean not within the insolvency, but a separate summons and complaint on that issue that would result in a decision one way or the other that would then be used in the insolvency. And that's the status of that one.
Well, but Julie brought it up, though. In the scale of complexity, this is pretty complex.
Yes, it is. Anderson, very complex.
In setting and this is maybe, correct me if I get too far down the road, the executive session, but I mean, this is something that we we're in the early stages of it, so there's not, this is not a 2-month deal.
Oh, heavens no.
Right. Just to Mr. Jensen and the commitment it'll take to do what's right here, we're talking a year.
And that would be fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There has been some discussion, and as soon as a few things fall into place, we might proceed on it. The big one for this thing I'm about to mention is getting the rest of the information from the company, which has not been easy, and we have had to try to, you know, be more formal about it in discovery.
From Legomix or Anderson?
Well, it's because Anderson's information is now kind of controlled by Legomix. And so one's saying I don't have it and I can't give it to you, and the other, that's been the issue. But there has been talk that if we could get that information, that we might be able to assess the credit sale claimants and ask the judge to sever that while this other thing's going on over the seed and get those people paid. As soon as we get more information from Anderson / Legomix, we would proceed to try to perhaps sever that with the court's permission.
In both of these, and I'm assuming the next one, how does this stuff move forward? Who's driving it?
Well, it's basically staff, but the problem is if staff is not getting the information that it needs, then you have to become formal in
right.
your court case, like doing discovery or a deposition or whatever.
And like in the Mitchell one that we just talked about, are we holding this up?
No. That one is a pure staff resource issue.
Our staff.
Our staff, yes. Getting to these little bits of projects.
Right, and how many people are waiting for us on that one?
Oh, Mitchell Feeds must be about 25 or 26 claimants.
And when did it start?
A long time ago.
1151, I believe it was around, must have been January, February of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
51 okay. is a pretty low number.
Yeah.
Well, you've been in contact with all the people, and everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And
I don't know when we filed with court. I don't know how early we filed, because I remember we worked on that whole should we go into Minnesota part of it first.
Are we dealing with this? With the staff requests we've got, is this to help move things like this along? Obviously, you guys aren't sitting around. We realize you're very busy, so how do we
But that's help? That goes back to the rationale for the legal people. I mean, we only have one general counsel, and if there was someone dedicated fully to Mitchell Seeds, that maybe would save time here or there. And that's the discussion we had back in December of, okay, priority, session.
Mm-hmm.
New commissioners coming in, we'll get on this as soon as we can. And that's even one more argument when it comes time for having the resources to get people.
Well, and we're hiring an attorney, so that person will be available to help.
Well, but there's a separate, we had the initial legal discussion, but this attorney, Public Utilities, is up to their elbows now too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wherever we put he or she at, it's certainly a discussion that legal counsel would weigh in on, but we could make a decision that, you know, we also have a rate case that needs an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely, if the new attorney does all public utilities, which is what the theory is at this point in time, it's still going to free up some of my time because I have to do some of the public utility stuff now as it comes up. So,
and we have funds now to use to help sub out legal work too, don't we?
Not for grain elevators, we don't.
We don't have any special funds. It's only whatever excess operating we might have, which I think is being, people are pulling on it in all directions. I don't know. But,
no, but that's what we're paying for John is through some of that money.
Yes, for Anderson.
Right.
You know, for Mitchell.
But you also get to a point, too, where, I mean, your question is a very good one about how do we assess priorities for staff to move forward. It's a very challenging question. But I feel comfortable that the expertise that these two have in Mitchell Seeds is probably not any benefit to bring anybody, and they're going to see this one through. But it really lays the question the next time it comes, don't fall into the temptation to dump it on Alana, even though it's sometimes the quickest answer, is to get the resources so it can be on somebody else. So then there's somebody out there that's driving this with not the 10 different directions we're being pulled here.
Initially, this was going to be Mark's case. I mean,
it's true. It was.
Things just happened that made it hard to accomplish because he had the Minnesota license. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was like the magic thing. And he was going to learn to do an insolvency, you know. And so it just sort of dissolved away. And then I have been trying to get some brainstorming going and some advice with Doug Anderson, who is a very good resource. And at one point, we thought of him handling this for us, but he got maxed out in the AG's office. They're just so overworked. But cool. He's very good in this type of work, at least to, you know, throw some ideas around with. Mm-hmm. And he and I have to have a meeting. We've played a tiny bit of telephone tag, and that's where it's at.
But the answer, though, from a answer would be, it is our responsibility to make sure it moves forward, particularly the portfolio holder who has it. And that's where, I mean, Tony really set the stage on most of this stuff when he was here. And then when Bonnie came in, kind of same thing. But that's where we've talked before. One of the first questions I asked Alana, I said, how do you keep track of all these cases and what goes where? And back a few years ago, decades ago, the commission would sit down with staff and go through every case. Mm-hmm. They convinced the commissioners they convinced commissioners that was not the best use of commissioner time or staff time. But that was the way that was done, because with all these cases, it's really hard to assess which priorities. So I look at it that I get in my head what I think are the priorities, and each of us will develop that over time. And then if we're not on track, the staff experts will tell us. Mm-hmm. That's like the other day I said what I thought was my biggest priority in one of the other meetings we had.
Yeah, so this one, like Mitchell Seeds, assuming after session you can get back at it, what are we looking at time-wise? I mean,
we're not looking at two, depends on which track we decide to take.
We're back on Mitchell Seeds now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on Mitchell, yeah. We will schedule that meeting, it's something that we can commit to being ready for, and we will, excuse me, Daryl, would you check with John if you're going out,
yes,
please? Because I have testimony any minute down there. See if anybody's called him or anything or emailed. Thanks.
You get the 3:00?
Well, yeah, except there was one other bill they mentioned.
And you and I got
mentioned.
The 4:00.
Yeah. So
maybe give us the quick spin up on the other one, then if we need to continue after you leave, soup.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, the other one, okay, Falkirk, is that the other one?
Mm-hmm.
12-769. Falkirk's the easiest at this point because nothing's started yet. We're appointed trustee. We have beans to liquidate. Is that done yet?
Some have been liquidated and
we're getting information, I hope, from the company. The notice period is probably pending, correct? Okay, we've sent it out.
Should be the last publication date.
Today?
Yep, should be, assuming that they the publications as they were
scheduling
them.
Okay.
Yes, so.
Yeah, that's another issue. So the date's 45 days from today, then, or from tomorrow, starting tomorrow, would be the ending period. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we have as big an issue in Falkirk with, like, getting information. You know, they've had kind of their own internal wrap-up going on with a good attorney's and who understands the process, and they work with us. So there's other issues in Falkirk, but I don't think getting information is going to be one of them.
And Tim was up there and took a look at all the records, so he believes he has everything that he needs for each of the claimants. We have a good idea who we believe each of the claimants are.
You're not a claimant in Falkirk, are you?
No. Well, are we going to keep getting more? Or are we pretty confident?
We hope not.
We never know. We hope not, but it's always possible that you do, which is why we have to do the publication, even if we think we have a list of everybody.
Oh, you meant more claimants. I thought you meant more insolvency.
Oh,
Either way.
You meant claimants, right? Yeah.
Claimants.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, we don't. If the time period hasn't run, mm-hmm, you know, you can always get somebody else.
When is the time period up? March something, you said?
It should be around the middle. I think the
45 days from
16th is
tomorrow.
What it'll be.
So how do you assess this one? Just by your experience based on Anderson Seeds, is this more or less difficult than an Anderson Seeds?
This is substantially less difficult.
Easier.
Mitchell Seeds, more or less difficult.
Substantially less difficult.
Yeah,
Mitchell has this Minnesota judgment thing that probably, you know, you could work here 30 years and not come up with that, having to deal with that issue.
Yeah.
And Anderson, you know, has big, complicated...
But is Falkirk one that the new attorney coming in could get
yes
in the middle of?
Yes.
In addition to, because we've talked about public utilities, and we have to have help there, but I still would like to talk to my colleagues too, of course, but mm-hmm, getting the new attorney their feet wet in grain elevators too, because mm-hmm, this is still our only, we don't have a way to recoup any costs. Mm-hmm. And the experience may be none, but they have to learn somewhere.
Yeah. The process is pretty well defined.
Yeah.
the step, and it's only like when you get these unique legal issues that, that slow you down. But the process is, you know, if you do one, you learn a lot, and it's not, it's manageable. So.
And I was just going to say, in Falkirk, I mean, the claims are pretty straightforward. There may be a question, a minor question regarding one person, and there may be a question regarding a possible cash claim or not.
Okay. The if you two have time, or if you all have time, I thought it might be worthwhile just to throw some general discussion about grain elevators and insolvencies and some of the things that we've seen, to where when you issue out a bond, can you kind of walk us through how you issue out that bond level? When someone comes in to do an elevator, what do you do to figure out the bond amount the elevator is going to charge?
Well, for what the elevator has to, for what an elevator has to file a state facility, it is based on the physical capacity of everything that they are licensing, and then there's a schedule.
It's in the rule, right?
I mean, yes.
You can look this up in the rule.
Right.
I mean, with a farmer could, I mean, an elevator could.
Yes, yeah. With a minimum bond of $50,000 is where the minimum sits. And it's approximately 50 cents a bushel up to through 500,000 bushels. And then after 500,000 bushels, it is 20 cents a bushel.
Now, the federal bond, how would that compare to the state bond? Because I think, well.
Theirs is based, I'm not sure if it's based on capacity or what they base it on, but a federal bond is different in that the federal facilities have to file a grain buyer's license with us, and for our bond, it's based on whatever their handle is.
Okay.
And that's supposed to be set up so that it's somewhat comparable to what a grain warehouse is. With a state facility, the maximum bond is $1.5 million unless the commission deems that a higher bond is necessary. With a federal bond, the maximum amount is $1 million, and that's because they very likely have a $500,000 or more bond that they have filed to get their United States Warehouse Act license. And then roving grain buyers works the same way. It is based on what your handle is, your bushel handle, not dollar handle. And then, but that maximum bond is $1.5 million.
So when we get questions that three of us will get always about the PSC should raise the bond level, really the set in rules, so the PSC can't just raise the bond level, correct?
We'd have to have a rulemaking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, so there is that provision in law about setting a special bond in certain special circumstances or something. There's some discretion.
If you deem it, if you deem it necessary, then you can ask for a higher bond.
Yeah, which we've considered a few times.
Mm-hmm. We've had discussions on that, and a couple of years ago there was a lot more legislative. There was a legislative committee that was formed for us to review that, and there wasn't much synergy to do that. And I brought up the federal bonds because if the state bonds get so high, we just will naturally push people. Thank you, Lana. See at four, hopefully? Okay. We will naturally push people to the federal bond, correct? I mean, that's my assumption of it.
Well, some, I think that's maybe I believe that that's a little bit less of an argument now because it seems like with the feds, they seem to draw the more, the term that the industry uses is it seems like they cherry pick them. The companies really have to be in a better financial situation in order for the feds even to give them a federal
license.
Is that
tightened up over the last couple of years?
I think it has some, probably. Remember, our bonds, and I don't know if you're aware of this, Commissioner, but in 1999, our bonds changed from being a dollar a bushel for the first 500,000 to 50 cents. And part of the movement for that was because of the fear, the concern about pushing the companies away from the state and over to the feds. But I think their financial requirements have become a little bit higher. I mean, what they're looking at, in order, you know, you have to have so much working capital. And as those have increased, I think it's made it harder for a company that isn't really financially sound to be able
we
to get.
Have we seen any grain insolvencies on elevators with federal bonds in
Not
North Dakota?
Not since Wimbledon, and that was in 2002.
Okay. I'm just throwing out things that I picked up along the way that took a while.
Even in other states, they have very few of them. I remember asking somebody from Kansas City And I think since Wimbledon, if I remember correctly, that, and like I said, that was 2002, I think they've had one failure. But they are looking at, I mean, they don't license little mom-and-pop operations, and they, you know, for the most part, I don't know how much they license local cooperatives. They, your Conagras, your Cargills, your Gavilons, your Continentals, the Columbia Grains, the bigger companies are the ones that we generally will see have a federal license, or companies that are operating in multiple states.
Okay. That was all that I really had, I guess, additional questions. I don't know if Julie or Randy.
I do think there's a lot more push from the legislature this time to dig into this farther than what the previous attempt, what was that, 4 or 6 years ago?
4 years ago was my first session.
Well, yeah, what's going on with the, what kind of bills are out there, or what are legislators talking about?
Well, what I hear talked about is it seems like a strong desire to do something, but I think everybody's a little unsure of what to do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are asking me, and I'm not sure either.
Well, and that's why I pointed out the variables.
It's a tough problem, but it's a problem that's growing.
But is it growing, though? Because when we looked at the numbers, we haven't had any more insolvencies in the last 10 years than we had in the previous 10 years. Just the value of the commodities. When you put those numbers together before, it didn't, 2-3 a year is kind of what the trend was for a long time. But now the value of these things has become such.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, since 2007, they have been happening at a little bit more frequent.
Maybe could you put those numbers together again, Sue?
Mm-hmm.
Because do kind of the same drill we did before, because they came before and asked us what to do, they being Chet Pollard and Wanzik, and we had. And I forwarded you, ironically enough, both that letter I got from the corn grower, Tom Lilja.
Lilja, yeah.
They were the only group that supported it. There was all this consternation about it, and we got all the groups together and said, okay, will you support raising the bond? They wouldn't, so we kind of, it died. So I think until you get the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union, and the corn growers, and the grain men, and boom, 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 to... We asked them, what's your recommendation?
Now, am I wrong in concluding that the grain men really don't want to do that?
They absolutely do not want to raise a bond.
Yeah, so getting them on board would maybe be tough.
Yeah, I think the bond's a small part of the solution.
Yeah.
And I think the Grain Dealers Association overall would be less supportive. You might get more support individually from farmer cooperatives.
Oh.
Because we have some farmer co-ops that have carried a higher bond than what they're actually required to carry, and they just
their boards,
it looks
directors.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they like having that extra comfort level for their patrons, you know. So over the years, some of them have been higher.
Go ahead, Sue. So.
I was just going to say, and when I've had a lot of people that have stopped in to see me with Anderson Seed, and when they express their, you know, concern and disappointment in what we have for bonds or how the indemnity fund works, I suggested that they contact their Farmers Union, your Farm Bureau, go to each of your commodity groups, talk to your local legislators, and I mean, if you really feel that something should be done so that you have more protection, just make it known out there. They're going to pay for the bond. They're probably going to get, you know, your operating expenses all get passed on. But
what those farmers, unless you expect them to sit and read the Century Code, and they're just not going to do that. Most of them don't understand all these distinctions. They think when they do business at a place with a bond that their business is covered. But if they sell their grain to get paid in 2 months, then it's not covered by the bond. It's covered by the indemnity fund. If they're buying something there, it's not covered by anything. And, I mean, we've got this so complicated. Nobody knows
That's the complication of trying to protect people.
I'm not there.
It's just tough because where do you stop and how do you protect them enough? And the more you protect them, the less responsibility you place on them to make sure that they're doing things, you know, the way that they can. Now, I understand that they're sort of a captive audience to the elevator in their area, and there are extenuating circumstances. But Are there, and again, I kind of hesitate to even go down this path for the same reason, is the more you do, the more you're acting as if you're taking care of the folks or protecting them. But are there other elements? You mentioned that this is just one part of it, Randy, that, you know, the bond. Are there other things like
the that you actually and don't cover would be helpful?
Yeah, or, you know, things that we can be looking at more, requiring annual audits of the of their financials. That was something that John Jensen, who spoke at, he spoke, wasn't he the attorney who spoke? I think that was John Jensen from Grand Forks.
Wasn't it Anderson or so?
I'm drawing a blank. I can't believe I can't think of it. He teaches up at UAB.
A big, tall guy.
Also. Yeah, is it Anderson or Johnson? I can't remember who it is. I'm just totally drawing a blank.
Well, anyway, he was one thing that he suggested to the co-ops that they start doing themselves is requiring an annual audit of their financials so that they kind of know what's sort and an outside one, not just asking your business manager for the books or to look at the books, getting an outside person. So I don't know if that's something, you know, an in-between step that would accomplish anything or not.
I don't know, since the troubles of what do you call the account, the new accounting laws?
Dodd-Frank?
No, that's the banking, but...
Well,
since then...
Yeah, Arthur Anderson, when they broke up, yeah.
The organizations I'm involved with, you know, you get these audits, and you get 20 pages of explaining why if there's something wrong, the auditor would have never known. you know, I don't know, it's kind of meaningless, too, but I was going to say, I'm a little defensive about it, I'll admit, but when we talk about, well, we can't protect everybody, one of the big problems is here, our laws sure protect the lenders.
Oh, the banks have first bite at the apple.
And
mm-hmm.
so
for the most part,
to act like or you know, suggest that us not doing anything is, you know, staying neutral isn't the case because we've already tipped everything way to one side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no time to just walk away.
Well, but the things like when Sue and I have talked more and with Tim and Mike is that simple things like converting your trip ticket, your tickets in 45 days would solve a lot of problems. And when I go talk to all these groups, like even when I spoke to the Farm Bureau, or not the Farm Bureau, the convention that night, I talked about joke stuff and they were all paying attention. Then I started talking about convert your tickets and do things and they got the glazed over look. And so it's like anything we can do to go back to these farmers mm-hmm. and ranchers and remind them of the basics, convert their tickets, make sure they know who they're doing business with.
Good that, business practices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I asked to speak at the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union and the corn growers, and I would say for all both of us, anytime we can get audiences in front of those groups and remind them, just like we're called for you dig, you know, convert your tickets, because most of these problems that we've had, the insolvencies, there was something that ticked early on converting their tickets that manifested over time because they were working these deals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity for the PSC to do a lot more. We just tend to get so focused on all the energy stuff, we forget about this, and this is just as important as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I think what we've heard once we started getting claims in Anderson as an example is, well, I've been doing business with them for 6 years or 8 years or whatever, and they were always slow, so I didn't worry about it. And it's like, well, it would be nice as soon as they're slow the first time. It would be nice if they were putting pressure on them.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, I mean, they want them to succeed. And
at the same time, I mean, it's a small volume for us compared to this. Here we're talking about a big volume for individual farmers, but
mm-hmm.
I seen one of the businesses that were in here, seen the list of people that haven't paid for some pretty long times yesterday, and I don't see us racing out there. I'll shook up about it. We assume we're going to get it, and I'm not sure how alarmed people can be, but I don't mean to suggest either that farmers don't have to start being more cautious, because we do.
Sue, what is the one we signed that compliance order right before the first of the year up in the Harvey Belt?
A memorandum of agreement with Earth Harvest Mills.
Yes. Is that appropriate to provide an update on that really quick, or is that a maybe actually?
Well, I was kind of planning on talking about it, and I mentioned something to Lana, and she asked that I not talk about it because it wasn't on the agenda.
No. Okay. But can we do this then? Could you provide the next commission meeting just a quick update on that?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, she's right. We've got to stay focused on what we've announced out there. Yeah. But that's a good topic to talk about.
Yes.
Well, under that caveat, I think we're probably wrapped up in the legal update. All right. Anything else? Legally, questions?
Legislatively?
No, legal, with these three cases that we're meeting on.
So there really isn't much. Are there any bills, like, in to deal with this bonding or any of that stuff? I know that there's been talk about some.
1403, I think, is the only one I've seen.
On the
so
indemnity
far.
Fund.
Yeah.
There's a Senate bill coming in to study prepaid.
Oh, the study, yeah.
We haven't seen that one yet. Is it out, actually? Do you know?
Well, I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I mean, I seen when it was not submitted yet.
Didn't we see it on our list? I thought I remember reading something about a study of this on the list, but I could be confusing it.
On the indemnity fund.
Oh, what are they studying on the indemnity fund?
That 1403 is the House bill that would study the indemnity fund issues. And I think what they want to study is, do we have enough money in there at $6 million? And should prepaid things also be covered by the indemnity fund?
All right.
The Senate bill, I think, is asking to study the problems around prepays, which have no coverage under any of the things we've talked about.
You know, I talked to Peril Grossman up in Consumer Fraud Division because he got pulled in a little bit on Falkirk Farmers Elevator when they were going through their liquidating, and ask him if he could think. I go, you know, you guys are consumer people up there. What can you think of anything that would equate to what you try to do when you're providing protection? And the only thing that he could come up with was, he said, maybe if it could be set up so that prepaids have to go into a trust fund, the money when it gets prepaid, rather than going into the elevators operating, it would go into a trust fund. But I guess I'm not sure if that would be workable, would always be workable for the elevators. And then I also called and talked to somebody down in the ag department to get a handle on, like, how many anhydrous or how many fertilizer dealers or what kind of licenses you issue down there. And he talked about how a lot of the elevators, a fair amount of the elevators have permits or licenses through them. I think there was 300 and some of one type of license and 200 and some of the other. The only problem there is there's such a wide gamut as to who your fertilizer dealers are. It ranges from farmers to elevators to just, the agronomy type businesses. Right. But I don't know, would anybody ever prepay a farmer? If you had a farmer that was selling anhydrous, however it works through him, have you ever heard of a farmer prepaying another farmer for the anhydrous that they're?
Well, I don't know that. I can't say that I've specifically heard of it. But, I mean,
it
seems to me very logical and reasonable. I'm sure it happens all the time. Small farmers who don't have tanks and stuff like that, so you're going to have your neighbor come and do your seeding for you, and your neighbor is ordering $600,000 worth of fertilizer, and you need 50, and your neighbor says, well, give me $50,000 and I'll order the fertilizer. Otherwise, we're going to get to spring and there's not going to be fertilizer. I can't seed for you. And so you give him $50,000.
So then he's part of the $600,000.
He would be part of that pool of people that.
But we don't license them. That between those two farmers isn't really something for us to worry about. But I think what is for us to worry about is the elevator, because that's who we license.
Mm-hmm.
If they take that $650,000 and the whole board goes on a cruise with it or use it to pay back their lender,
gamble it on futures.
And mm-hmm. just say, well, you know, too bad.
I asked Tim, who's been with the commission for 15 years, if he recalls any insolvency, because I couldn't think of another one where prepaids were involved in. So I asked him, and he said he couldn't think of any. And I go, well, what happened? What about Wimbledon? Because Wimbledon was kind of a unique situation also. And he goes, with Wimbledon, he had heard rumors that the farmers had approached the owners, that company, about ordering prepaids, but they wouldn't offer the prepaids. And so thank goodness, because we would have seen this happen 11 years ago if we had. Yeah. So, you know, I think some of it comes into the management has to. Yeah,
and it's somewhat regional. Down there, don't they? And I don't understand whether it's because of the crops they raise or because of the soil that they have or what, but down there, I think dry fertilizer is much more prevalent. And a lot of the bigger farmers have buildings, and they go in and buy the fertilizer and take it home.
Could be.
But as a state, I don't know that it's for areas like northwest of here, where anhydrous is the type of fertilizer that works well. I don't know that we want all these farmers having farm storage tanks. And I mean, it's a volatile substance, and I don't know that we want these farm storage tanks on every section of land,
a
third of the state. And, of course, the elevators can't store enough, so, I mean, it's all a prepay thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the only way you have it.
It's kind of like just-in-time delivery. You pay, and then it comes when you need it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So do we want to schedule do you guys want a work session to talk about our position on bonds, or should we just wait till we'll go through the discussion on the bills?
Well, it seems like we're kind of, if we're going to throw anything into the mix, we're kind of too late, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I do.
Some bill that would get amended that would
we're adding to the studies or something, maybe. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was at, but I just wanted to double check.
Yeah.
But I seem like that one on the indemnity fund, didn't that go into our file on the lesser, the ones that don't impact us, but we're just...
I don't remember.
Anything can be moved if it did.
Watching I ask it for it to be under effect rather than...
Yeah, I think it should be.
Or impact rather than effect. Because
double check tomorrow it's there, because I don't remember.
I'll check with John. There was two of them. There was that one, and there was another one I asked.
I'm sure we get this meeting tomorrow, too.
Oh, there was one relating to railroad crossings, too. I'm good.
Let's
wrap this up.
I think that there should be those study of some of this stuff, and I think we should play a role in it from the beginning.
Maybe you can sit on the study group.
Okay.
I was going to mention to you also that I had, and it's been a while, a frequently asked questions document, so that anybody that could go to our website and they could go in and look at it, and it would answer questions about buying grain and who needs a license and who doesn't and the bonding and all of that. And so I have resurrected that again, and I have one that is almost in a final draft version, and when I finished with that, I was going to give it to you guys and get your blessing for it. And then I was thinking if we could put it on our website. And the other thing I was thinking is if maybe the ag department, I think sometimes people, when they call because they're looking for grain elevators, they think ag, not public service commission. Mm. They'll call down there and they'll transfer their number. So if they're looking online and they don't find something relating to grain buying on the website, are they picking up a phone and calling the ag department, or are they maybe giving up? And so I thought maybe if they would be willing to put a link that if you have a question regarding grain buying, that, you know, it would link to our website and they could pull some information.
Okay. Those would be good.
All right, thank you, Sue. With that, let's close the work session on case numbers GE 11-51, GE 12-78, and GE 12-769. Thanks, Sue.